Hello and welcome. This is Katie Curtin, Creativity and Money Coach. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our 10-day Money Magic Marathon Expert Talk with Peggy Lusk. And Peggy is a financial renegade and founder of Abundance by Design. She's a business consultant and financial coach, and she broke away from corporate America to create her own life of abundance. A cornerstone of her business is the belief that how you spend your time is just as important as how much money is left later. Peggy earned undergraduate degrees in business administration and information science from Eastern Washington University, and a master's degree in information systems management from Seattle Pacific University. She's not a stuffy accountant, and she lives in Washington State and is happily married. She loves riding her Harley along scenic mountain routes with friends, reading inspirational books, keeping healthy, and following spiritual pursuits. So welcome, Peggy. It's a real privilege to have you here with us as part of this 10-day Money Magic Marathon.
Thank you, Katie. It's great to be here.
And we're going to start out with asking you, how did you develop an interest in finance? And why is it a real passion for you?
Well, there was actually probably several drivers for me. The first and probably biggest one is that I was born the oldest child of five, actually, that my mom had. And the first four of us were born kind of grouped together within a five-year time span, if you can imagine that. Mm. And by the time I was five, my mother was divorced. So I understood early on the impact of really, you know, growing up with not a whole lot of funds available, watching a mom, you know, struggle to put herself through school and joining the workforce and that kind of thing. The other piece was that I seem to have always had a natural talent with numbers. I never really knew where that came from until I reached adulthood and realized that that was probably a characteristic I picked up from my father, who actually was the head bank inspector for the state of Alaska. I never knew that because I didn't really have any contact with my dad until I was in my mid-20s. And I've kind of, in a way, lucked out and followed the urgings of my higher power, which kind of caused me to look at the things that I had talents for. And even though they were really different than most of the things that the rest of my family had in the way of skill sets, I've kind of used those things to guide my way through life. So many of the things that I've done with my adult life are things that I thought everyone did. But I kind of did them because they worked for me. And the biggest one there is that I've just always been interested in learning new things and improving, you know, what I'm currently doing. And so I've always been out there kind of searching for, you know, what's on the horizon and what kind of changes I need to make. So that's been kind of a driving passion for me. And finance, although that sounds like a dull, boring subject, there's a lot of change happening. Probably much more obvious to people in the last 5 years than it used to be.
And yes, so you started out in information science, and I believe you're very, very good at that. You always seem to have the answers to any questions I have on that, or on the, well, not on information science as such, but on computer technology and how to use it. So how did you go from being in that field to actually getting into working with people on their budgets and finances? And
well, strange as this is going to sound, I really have always combined both worlds. I originally started, when I got out of high school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. So I didn't go straight to college like a lot of kids my age did. I worked for a couple of years in a department store and eventually worked my way up to what is called a head cashier, which is similar to like a teller in a bank. So I was in charge of all the money for the whole entire building. And I got very interested in that piece of things and wanted to go on and get my accounting degree. And so that was my original goal. I went to a community college in Spokane with the idea of getting an accounting degree and eventually becoming a CPA. This was like, you know, my back of mind goal. And I had an accounting instructor who said, you know, computers are really the wave of the future. Accountants need to know everything they can know about computers to be successful. So I would suggest you start with this two-year technical program we've got in, at that time they called it data processing. Learn all you can with that. And if you don't like it, you can always, you know, transfer back over to accounting, but you'll have all this knowledge. So I thought, oh, that makes sense. So I signed up for this two-year technical program and got so enamored with computers that I finished that program off, went to work actually in the banking industry primarily, as a computer programmer. And then after doing that for a few years, I decided that I wanted to complete my undergraduate degree. So I took a job as a computer operator on the swing shift so that I could finish off my undergraduate degree. And that actually was in accounting and information systems. So that the two combined, I had an undergraduate degree in professional accounting. And then I went on right after I graduated, studied for the CPA exam. Passed that. It took me like three tries to pass it because I didn't have any audit experience, but I am still a Washington State-based CPA. I still maintain that license. And I, from then on, have really worked both worlds. I've been able to help small businesses, for instance, get their books set up, typically in an automated fashion, and do all the tracking and support that they want to do, and then help them, you know, by training maybe somebody they want to outsource it to, or taking pieces on that they didn't want, like quarterly reporting and end of year taxes and that sort of thing. So I've always done both worlds.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know you knew all those things as well. So
yeah.
A real fount of knowledge. And that's only part of it. I know you're like many of us, of us with many passions, you've got your fingers in a lot of different worlds. So
yep.
I would like to ask you how you define abundance.
Well, abundance to me is having what you need when you need it so that your life choices are made based on your values and your priorities. So it's not really a quantity of money. It's not really how much money you have, but it's how you feel about what you have. So abundance includes things like doing what you love, and that for me is really a cornerstone of having abundance in your life. If you waste your money, you're only out of money. But if you waste your life, if you waste your time, You've lost a part of your life that you really can't recover. I mean, money, you can spend it, re-earn it. If you have a financial loss, you can eventually regain it. But if you don't invest the scarce time resources you have doing things that you really have a passion about, you can't ever reclaim that.
Mm.
That makes sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that could allow certain people on the call to even redefine how abundant they are, because a lot of us may not have huge resources financially, but we sure have a lot more time and are doing what we passionately believe in than a lot of people out there. And so
I think
that's
one
really
thing related to that is that you don't want to confuse having less with being less and having more with being more, or that what you have is who you are. It's important to be yourself, love yourself, accept yourself, and that's just part of your whole life design.
Oh, that's so important to say, and in fact, that's one of the things that we'll be clearing and working on in this 10-day money marathon, is clearing those equations that we have in our, you know, in our subconscious that really drive us, that having less means being less, and also that somehow by having more wealth that we're going to prove ourselves or that we're going to be worth
exactly.
more.
Exactly.
Excellent point there. So what I would like to go into now is, why is it so important to know what values you have when you look at your finances and design for a life of abundance?
Well, the big thing is that if you haven't taken the time to think about the values that are important to you, you're likely going to end up living the values of your parents, possibly, or
yeah.
some of the other important people around you, or, you know, for those of us in internet marketing, you might be following the gurus around you, and you'll wake up one day thinking, wow, this is not where I thought my life was going to be, and I'm not overly happy with it. You can't really wait until later to live your values. Because we don't know from the time we're born exactly how much time we're going to have. Life isn't about just waiting for the storm to pass. It's about learning to dance in the rain and learning to enjoy, you know, all of the time that you have here. And if you're focused on, you know, just going through the motions of a job or some traditional values that you think you should adhere to, you're going to miss your life. Does that make sense?
That's so true. That's so true. And I love how you put it. You need to learn to dance in the rain.
Especially if you live in Seattle.
Yeah. Enjoy now. Whatever's
on
your plate.
You got to learn to ride in the rain, too.
Yes. Because certainly life is full of rain and sunshine.
Exactly.
And if we're only good in the sunshine, well, we're going to have a hard time. So we were talking about how it's important to know your values. And I know that you think that there are four pillars for creating an abundant lifestyle based on your values. Please tell me about these more.
Okay, all right. The four main pillars are related somewhat, you know, to the tracking and metrics, but they start with a number one pillar of the individual themselves. So this encompasses a lot of things like their overall health, because believe it or not, health has a major impact on all kinds of facets of your finances, facets you may not even have thought about. I can give an excellent example. My husband, after years of having a weight issue, decided to follow in my footsteps of trying to get his weight down, took about 25 pounds off, and as a result of that, was able to get completely off of his prescription drugs. Okay, so there was an investment up front of him to do some things to improve his health. There was investment of time, there was investment of money. But as a result of that, there was a return, you know, monetarily, and downstream, that impact is going to be even greater, because your health impacts so many facets of your finances. The other piece that is related to the individual is risk tolerance. And some of this is maybe factors that you either were born with or kind of grew up with based on your family surroundings, but everyone has a different amount of risk that they're just comfortable with. And that will impact what types of things you want to invest your finances and your time in moving forward. A lot of it is also centered around your whole life attitude in terms of, you know, being positive and receptive and open to change and that kind of thing. So, and your family structure, the individual family structure, also has a lot to do with your finances. In other words, if you are, you know, if you're single and you don't have any kids, you know, your attitudes about what you might want to leave when you pass on will be totally different than someone who has a very large family and lots of children. Another cornerstone of leading an abundant lifestyle is creating a financial foundation. All of the foundational areas are related to covering risk. So naturally, people who have a higher tolerance for risk will have a totally different set of foundational principles than someone who is pretty laid back about that. But this includes things like setting up your emergency funds. It used to be that a common rule of thumb was that you needed to have emergency funds that would cover 6 months worth of your normal living expenses without you having to cash in something that you might take a major loss on, like, for instance, having to sell a piece of real estate really rapidly or selling a stock, for instance, prematurely. So these funds should be something that are very liquid, that you know, you're not going to take a penalty on to pull them out. Another foundational issue is various types of insurance coverages, whether they're employer-provided insurance or whether they're something that you have private coverage on. So these are things that would be able to handle job changes, for instance. So in other words, you may want to have some things put in place that if you move from employer to employer, you're still going to have the coverage related to that. You also need to watch things like your own personal insurability. So this, again, relates a lot to the health. If you've got things like health insurance or disability insurance or life insurance, those are all very, very related back to your own individual health. There are a lot of policies that people assume that their employer has provided. I know people think that their employer has provided them disability coverage when really what they have instead is disability pay for a certain period of time. That's not the same as, gosh, what if you're permanently disabled and you need to have a paycheck, for instance, that comes in possibly for the rest of your life. Life insurance is something that if you have only an employer policy and something happens that you leave that employer, either because you quit or you became disabled, for instance, your life insurance wouldn't go with you. And so in many times that, depending on, again, whether you have family or not, that may be an issue as far as something to look for. And then there's also things like long-term care insurance, which is becoming a really popular thing for people to carry now to cover. A lot of people assume that's for older adults. It may not be. I actually had a brother at the age of 21 that needed long-term care. Property and casualty insurance for things like your car insurance or your home insurance. Another piece that people don't really think about would be an umbrella policy to cover you personally in case of a lawsuit, for instance, for a car wreck or somebody maybe being injured in your home. And then there's the legal piece of the foundational structure, and that is things like wills and trusts and beneficiary designations and all of this kind of thing. So this is a big piece, and it's something, pieces of this are essential to everybody's financial plan. The next cornerstone is what I refer to as cash flow, and this is the impact of your various revenue-generating activities on your overall health and happiness. So the revenue might be income from a full-time job or a part-time job. It may be from a business that you have. It may be your investments in real estate or stocks or bonds, that kind of thing. And then it also includes your spending. And there's two, really, I bracket the spending in terms of two different types of spending. There's what I would refer to as good spending, which is something that is going to build your asset base over time. And then there's bad spending, which is typically a depreciable asset of some sort that the minute you invest in it, it's already worth less than what you paid for it. So an example of that, for instance, might be a car. And then there's the way that you finance those types of spending. The big thing in the cash flow arena that I want people to get, though, is that you want to focus not just on reducing your expenses, which seems to be, you know, where a lot of people focus on, but you also want to focus on things that you can do to increase your revenue. And you may need to assume some risk in order to move forward in some cases. So the big question you want to ask yourself in this arena is, are you moving closer to your overall goals, or are you moving further away? Because you're always going to be doing one or the other. You don't really stay in a static state. An excellent book that kind of talks about this principle is a book called The Slight Edge that was written by a man named Jeff Olson. And it talks about turning simple disciplines into a massive success. So it talks about little things that you can do on a daily basis that will cause major shifts and keep you on that upward trend. And the last piece of this whole structure is your overall assets. So starting from when you're really young all the way through your life, your primary objective is to have enough assets to live on until you pass away. So one of the key metrics that's used for measuring this is something called net worth. And really all net worth is your overall assets minus your overall liabilities. That kind of just gives you a figure. If that figure happens to be negative, in other words, a lot of us typically when we graduate from high school probably don't have a whole lot in assets except ourselves, our own personal intellect and drive and that sort of thing. And so we might show negative if we right away started assuming some debt, like to put us through college, for instance, that kind of thing. When you're in a negative worth situation, that's what would typically be described as a potential for bankruptcy. Now, typically that wouldn't apply to somebody right out of college who doesn't really own anything but has a massive, you know, college debt, because they've got their own personal human life value that kind of keeps them from being bankrupt. But somebody who is getting ready to retire, maybe age 60, that is sitting in a negative net worth capacity, that might be a whole different situation. And another metric that kind of throws this off a little bit is that personal assets, like your home, for instance, or maybe your car, they are considered to be part of an overall net worth. But if you're trying to evaluate how much you have available to you as a retirement asset, you're not going to want to include those unless your plan is to liquidate those when you retire and live on those. You're typically going to have some sort of a home to live in, but, you know, and that, you know, downsizing might be an alternative to get you, you know, something for retirement assets. And there are, within the asset category, there are various types of assets. One of the typical measurements for your assets is above and below the line in terms of risk allocation. I don't know if you've heard that term before, Katie, but
I'm sort of going a little bit blurry around some of the terms.
Blurry, okay. Well, there typically is a line, a risk tolerance line, and anything that is referred to as above the line is considered to be an asset whose value can change dramatically on a dime. So in other words, stocks would always fall into that category because stocks really could be completely wiped out at any point in time. Mm-hmm. Assets that are below the line are typically things that maintain the value that they're expected to have, you know, 10 years from now. So that would be like CDs, for instance, have a quoted interest rate, and you know 10 years from now what that CD is supposed to be worth. Of course, inflation kind of, you know, does us in on that one. But what happens is that one of the guidelines for a rule of thumb that was defined by Wall Street is that if you're allocating your assets in terms of how much you should have above the line and how much you should have below the line, that percentage is going to typically change as you get older, and you need to be moving more conservative. Typically, the percentage would be, but you want to have below the line the same percentage as what you are in years. So in other words, a person who is 20 years old would put 20% of their assets below the line, very conservative, stable, and the other 80% could be much higher risk above the line investments because they're more of a long-term focus. Somebody who's 65 would want to put 65% of their assets below the line, stable and conservative, and the other 35 could be above the line. Is that making a little bit more sense?
Yes, it is. I'm having a bit of noise in the background here. I'm not sure if you can hear it. But I would like to actually go on to the question about financial challenges where you don't even have the ability to really do a lot of the saving. And some financial experts are very outspoken with advice to people going through financial challenges. And certainly there's a huge number of people facing bankruptcy or near bankruptcy now and going through enormous challenges throughout North America. Are there some guidelines that people are giving right now that you would take issue with? And what would you say for people going through real financial challenges?
Very good question. I do have, I would say to begin with that any kind of financial guidelines that are given out by anybody without a full understanding of that person's individual financial picture is in my mind tantamount to dispensing prescription medication without even diagnosing the disease. So when somebody hands you generalities and says, you know, this is what you always want to do, run, don't walk to the nearest exit. Because you really need to consider all the factors involved. And one of the ones that just grates on me every time I hear it is the term, is when somebody says buy term and invest the difference when they're talking about life insurance, for instance. Well, that whole platitude is based on a couple of assumptions. Number one is that you're actually going to be investing the difference. So in other words, you're paying a lesser amount for your life insurance, but you're taking that difference and you're putting it in the stock market or a business venture or something. And you're assuming that investment vehicle that you're putting the money into is going to grow more than what the increasing cost of your life insurance is going to be. Because all life insurance gets more and more expensive as you get older. Now, that may not be important if you've got an investment vehicle that is going to grow so rapidly that by the time you're 65 and retired that you don't need life insurance at all because you'll have this huge sum of money that will take care of you and take care of your family. But that's a false assumption to leave yourself with. So it really all depends on whether you want to have life insurance in place at the time you die for your whole life, no matter how old you are, or whether you only want your life insurance to be there for a certain period of time. And that needs to be analyzed by individual. Another thing that a lot of financial professionals do is that they assume that asset allocation, in other words, what percentage of your assets should be in higher risk things like stocks and bonds, and how much should be in safer investments, that all of that just needs to be considered with, a 401k or, a pre-tax investment of some sort, that your 401k is really all of your assets. And so they'll take the 401k and they'll try to do an asset allocation within that. 401k is really intended to be a long-term retirement investment. And as such, it needs to be invested in things that are a little bit more high risk. You need to have your other safe assets outside of the 401k if you've got one, a 401k or an IRA. And you also need to watch what kinds of things you're putting into a 401k because there are some investments that earn a tax-free status. Like, for instance, if you're investing in a municipal bond of some sort, you don't want to roll those into a 401k because when you do that, you'll lose all the benefits of having it be tax-free, and they may not be providing as good a return because of the tax-free status. The other one I mentioned briefly, which is including your personal residence in the calculation of your retirement assets. Some financial professionals just, they don't separate that out. And I've seen people being forced into liquidating their home at the time they retire just based on that. Another real biggie is focusing strictly on reducing debt and paying off your mortgage, which in my mind places you right up front in a scarcity mindset. And depending on how far you take this, it can actually jeopardize your assets long term. This recommendation is really intended for people who have massive debt and no assets. They may have gotten here from a health-related issue that can have a major impact, or just general overspending because the types of assets they were purchasing were some of these bad assets, these depreciable assets. And potentially they could be in a bankruptcy situation where they may have to totally clear the slate at that point and start all over again. But for someone who actually has a business or is working full-time and they're not in a situation where, you know, where they're what I would call bankrupt, in other words, their assets are not more than their liabilities, not allowing yourself to incur debt to finance necessary business expenses can actually cause your business to wither and die. You've got to incur some calculated risk in order to move forward. And paying off a mortgage or having that be a major focus of your attention, when a mortgage is something that gets preferential tax treatment and typically lower rates, this could be a really good source of financing for some other revenue-generating activities, you know, such as building a business. So forcing yourself to pay off your mortgage is going to kind of strangle you in terms of moving forward with building your asset base. The other thing if you are really, you know, gung-ho about paying off your mortgage, there are some things that you need to consider. Number one, you need to pay it off in full, and you need to do that with what I would refer to as spare assets. In other words, maybe it's, you know, some sort of investment asset that, you know, there's enough of it there to completely pay off your mortgage, and for whatever reason that is a focus for you right now. And there's a couple reasons for this. The big one is that if you own a large amount of equity in a real estate asset of any kind, but especially your own home, makes it a bigger target for the bank. So you're better off having your money in an emergency reserve where you can, you know, pay it if you need to out of your emergency reserve than taking your money and paying your mortgage off before you've built your emergency reserve. Are you following me there?
Yes.
Okay. And one thing that people don't really realize is that when you prepay your mortgage, it's not going to eliminate the need to make exactly the same amount of a mortgage payment the next month. So when you have done this prepayment, in a way, you're kind of letting the bank control your cash flow instead of you controlling your cash flow and being able to, you know, dive into that as you need. So another piece of this whole debt reduction idea is that you really need to consider the impact of interest rates. One example I can give you, and this actually should be considered not just for debt reduction, but also for purchasing decisions in a way. The last vehicle I bought, which is like several years ago now, but I actually bought a brand new vehicle because it was just exactly the vehicle I wanted, and you know, I knew I'd keep it for a long time. They gave me a choice of having an interest-free financing thing on the vehicle, or I could get a rebate. And so I actually sat down and calculated out how much that interest-free financing was worth. Because the vehicle was something I planned to keep long-term, I did that instead of the rebate. And then that became a non-priority for me to pay off early, because I was paying nothing for interest. So it would have been better to have paid off almost anything than to have paid that car off at that point.
Hmm.
And then a last factor here is that a lot of people, or a lot of financial advisors, urge you to place all of your retirement funds into some sort of a pre-tax retirement account, such as a 401k, or if you're not working for an employer that has one, putting things into an IRA. Those vehicles were actually created back in the early 80s when we were in a state where our tax rates were extremely high. And so for people who invested in a 401k back then, the income they would have received would have been taxed at an extremely high rate, and they're now pulling the money out in retirement at a lower rate, that whole principle worked really, really well. But for where we're at right now, which is a tax rate structure that really, we're not at the lowest we've ever been, but we're definitely, most people think we're at a rate that 10 years from now we're probably not going to see, that we're heading into a period where our tax rate structure is going to be increasing. You may be setting aside money that you would have been taxed at and a lower rate and pulling it out in retirement at a higher rate. So that's caused the Roth IRA, for instance, to become really popular, because a lot of the money is then taxed now as opposed to being taxed when you pull it out in retirement. Many people's 401k plans don't offer a Roth within that, and if they don't and your only alternative is a pre-tax investment vehicle, you really need to watch the way that you're investing there.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Peggy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as a lot of us are also Canadians, so
yes.
We have a bit of a different tax structure, but I assume that there's some similarities between them. I'm wondering, so thank you, but it certainly gave me a lot of insight around things like how you would decide to pay back debts if you're in that situation, and also ways to prevent going into bankruptcy by doing things that seem rather sensible, like paying off your mortgage or whatever. So that was very interesting. Now,
many people have actually gotten themselves into a situation where they have lost their homes because they were doing a lot of this prepayment to get the mortgage down and made themselves a vulnerable target for the banks.
Yeah, and that's very sad when you think you're being secure and you're doing the wrong thing completely. So that's a good pointer. Now, what I'm wondering is, do you have, I'd like to open up for questions pretty soon. However, I just have one question before we go into that. And is that, do you have any general financial guidelines of your own that you feel would apply to anyone?
Yeah, I do have a few. Probably the number one is that don't assume that because you're not writing a check to someone to monitor part of your assets that you're not somehow paying someone to do that. There are many times when some of these fees are included in a financial vehicle that you are investing in, and you may not even be aware of what that is. Case in point would be if you have a stockbroker who is monitoring all of your stock transactions, for instance, they're going to receive a commission. And many times that is based on the rate of churn with the asset. In other words, how many times they sell it, and that sort of thing. Life insurance agents typically receive a commission based on the number of policies that you have and maybe the types of policies. 401k managers are receiving a commission based on the dollars that are invested and the number of enrollees, and in some cases even the relationship with the business owner. So you need to understand that in those cases, there may be a potential for a conflict of interest And it may be better to actually pay someone to give you financial advice that is completely independent of the financial vehicle, in order to make sure that you're getting advice that you may be paying for that you're not realizing. And in many cases, you will do a better job of taking care of your assets than someone else. So it's really important to be engaged with your finances. It actually is a job that pays you more than some of the other jobs that you've got, and you know, maybe your best bet in the long run, because no one really cares more about your finances than you do. And there's really no one else who knows your true priorities and your true financial picture and is aware of the changes in them, you know, as they happen. Now, for areas that you don't have specific current understanding, it makes a great deal of sense to consult with an expert to learn from and possibly outsource some pieces of your activities. So in other words, if you're not a specialist in real estate, but that's something you're thinking about investing in, you want to learn all you can on your own about that, but you may want to enlist an expert, you know, to help you and guide you. Same thing with things like investments in precious metals or investments in stocks. But I do feel very strongly that you shouldn't invest in something that you don't understand, and that your investments should be something that you have a passion for. In other words, if you really like watching the stock market, you know, then you're an excellent candidate for investing in that arena. For me personally, that's probably not a high priority, because I don't like the risk factor involved with the stock market. But I have friends who are just really into it. Another couple of generalities about 401ks, and here again, I don't know how many people are U.S. based and whether that impacts you in Canada or not. But if you have
Most of the people here are Canadian, and there are a couple of U.S., so maybe we don't need to go into that in big detail. Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of things regarding the 401ks that you need to be aware of. If you've got one with a previous employer, you need to move it, because the employer is still controlling a lot of stuff about that investment, and they actually can institute, you know, withdrawal rules that may or may not, you know, work well for you. And based on what's going on with our current tax situation here in the U.S., you also may want to consider, you know, moving them to an after-tax vehicle and taking the tax hit on that. It's all an individual thing, and you really need to, you know, to work through with an expert on that. You also need to understand all of the IRS regulations regarding 401ks and IRAs as well before you invest in some of those, because there are a lot of rules associated with them that many people don't really know, especially as regards what happens to them if you pass away when you still have one of those active. You also need to consider multiple streams of revenue. This is like a really big thing for me. So if you're working at a full-time job, you need to have something else besides that full-time job that is bringing in some sort of a revenue source for you, so that if something happens to that job, you're not completely without some revenue coming in. And you need to aim for some of that multiple streams of income, with some of it being passive, so that if something happens to your health, for instance, that revenue stream could still continue. And here again, you know, it needs to be based on your passions and stuff that you would like staying involved with as an activity. Another one I'm going to talk about that may actually be a little controversial is that you need to make sure that you're providing for educational funding for yourself as a priority over providing for educational funding for your children. Now, where I'm going to come from with this, I'm going to give you the analogy, the airplane analogy. You know, they talk about the air mask, you know, dropping down, and how they want you to put that over your own mouth before you do what you need to do for the kids. It's the same principle, that if you're not investing in yourself to keep yourself able to be flexible and handle the changes that are going on in the world around you, you won't be able to provide for your family downstream. If you are doing all of that, you'll have the ability to help your kids. But don't scrimp on what you need for your business and yourself just to put money aside for the kids. Because whether or not they even go to college, I think is becoming a less important factor depending on, you know, what it is that they're going to do themselves with their own lives. Does that make sense?
Right, right. No, that's very interesting. I'd like to actually, Peggy, this is great stuff,
yeah.
But I'd like to open, because we spent quite a bit of time with the interview, I'd like to open it up for the questions so that people get to center on the topics that they find, you know, that they are really interested in and need some advice on. So I'm just going to take it off the lecture mode and open up for questions. So would does anybody have a question coming out of all the information that Peggy has presented?
Katie and Peggy?
Yes.
This is Candace Talmadge.
Great.
Peggy, thanks for a lot of information. I felt like I was back at the broker-dealer I used to work with.
Okay.
Talking about all these financial terms. Maybe I didn't understand you, but you talked about the problems with paying down your mortgage and paying a little bit extra. Why does that make you vulnerable to the bank? I'm not sure I get it. Maybe I'm just slow.
Okay. Well, let me use my own example as an analogy. My husband and I actually built our home about 10 years ago. And as a result of being an owner-builder, ended up with a lot of sweat equity built into the house. So we've got several hundred thousand dollars worth of equity that was built up even without us making mortgage payments on it, extra mortgage payments. But what happens is if you compare our situation where our real estate is not underwater to a situation where someone owes as much on the house as what the house is worth, trust me, the bank will come after me first.
Why is that?
They've got money they can make off of it.
Okay.
In other words, if they foreclose on my house, they can turn right around and sell it and get all of their money back easily. So if I were to, you know, end up being late on a payment or two, I would be a much more likely target than someone who is underwater on their house in terms of working with them to try and renegotiate their loan or reduce their payments or whatever it took.
I see. So if you've built up equity and you are now trying to add, say, $100 a month extra in principal, then you become a more attractive target for shady foreclosure practices.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what you want to do is if you've got that $100 a month that you want to put towards eventually paying down your mortgage, take it and put it in an account that's going to bring you, you know, a decent enough return on investment. I wouldn't put it like in a regular savings account at a bank, for instance, but someplace where you're going to get a reasonable return. Bank that away until you get a fund that is large enough to pay the mortgage off in full.
Well, when you say, you know, don't put it in a regular savings account, because obviously the interest on savings accounts is less than 1% these
days. It is, yeah. It's brutal.
What kind of account would give what would you consider a reasonable return?
Well, let's say that you invested in your business instead. And your business is making, you know, a 20% rate of return or something.
Okay.
You can at that point, when you build up your business enough to where the revenue stream has provided, you know, kind of a fund, so to speak, then take that full amount and pay the mortgage off in full.
Right.
In other words, you maintain control of it until you are at the point where you're ready to completely. I'm not saying that paying off a mortgage isn't a worthy venture. I think it is worthy. I just don't think it should be your highest priority.
Well, right, and it depends on what the interest in the mortgage is and everything like that.
Of course, yeah, definitely.
Because I actually benefited when, you know, during the late 90s and early 00s when everybody was being solicited by the banks, reduce your mortgage rate. Well, I didn't. Then I got a chance to pay off the mortgage to my house. So I effectively made the interest, the 8.5% interest that I used to be paying. I effectively made that rate on paying it off.
And so then what did you turn around then and do with, you know, are there any other areas, though, in terms of your overall asset portfolio where you're overly restricted now by having all of your money tied up in your house?
Not really. It's the cash flow. All right.
Okay.
That's where I am trying to, like you say, put that $100 or whatever it is. I'm trying to put it into my business and build that up so it provides for me. I get that. I mean, cash flow has sunk so many businesses and so many people.
Exactly.
People don't pay enough attention to it. It's like
exactly.
George, our mentor George, who I met Katie through, always says one of the big key metrics to pay attention to is how much revenue your business is bringing in per month.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I think where this really applies, let's take the example. Let's say, for instance, you didn't have a business of your own.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that instead you were working full-time in a corporate environment where your job could end at any time and you really have no passive income.
Right.
But your focus has been on paying off your mortgage. So you get to age 65 and you have your mortgage paid off and you have no passive income and you have no business ventures and you may not even have any retirement because a lot of companies don't really have those. And so unless you set money aside for that, instead of focusing on paying off your mortgage, you might not have that either. So then you get to age 65 and you have to sell your house because it's the only asset you have in order to have money to live on when you retire. I'm seeing that. I'm seeing people doing that because their focus has been, let's get out of debt, let's pay off the mortgage.
Right. Well, you know, the whole package.
Yes.
Well, and the whole dynamic of the house being Americans' biggest asset, you know, from the majority of Americans, that's all changed because of what's happened.
Well, I don't know that it really changed. I think what happened is that as a result of that asset not being in an increasing value state, that people became aware of the fact that just like any other investment, it can decline in value. I grew up in a town in Washington State where really up until I was in probably in my mid-30s, nobody bought real estate with the idea that it was going to increase in value. If you sold it and got all your money out of it, you were doing good. So people invested in real estate so that they had the tax write-off more than anything else because any money, of course, they were paying towards the mortgage at least, you know, was not going to rent. And so I didn't grow up with the attitude that, you know, hey, investing in my home, you know, was something that was always going to be an asset that increased in value.
Right.
But I do believe that you have to look at that differently than any other real estate investments that you make. Unless your plan is, and there are a lot of people who do this as well, who do an owner-builder thing where they build one house and then they take their equity out of that, sell it, build a whole nother house, take their equity out of that, build it, sell it, and eventually get to the point where they don't have a mortgage on their house because they've, you know, continued to roll it off that direction. But I still say if they don't have some other business venture and that is the only asset they have, that may be the asset they have to use for a retirement asset, and that it's not going to accomplish anything.
Well, you're
better off to take a mortgage against your house, which is a nice low interest rate compared to what you could get for a business loan, and invest in what you need to do to keep your business from starving.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense, except that I am so mistrustful of the entire banking system right now that I really don't want to put any part of my house at risk of foreclosure, because there's just been so much extensive fraud in foreclosure right now. That's my problem with the stock market. And these are just my personal opinions. I don't want to invest in the stock market anymore because it's not being controlled by anybody like me, and I think there's an epidemic of fraud that's not even being talked about.
Well, I'm not really sure that I see an epidemic of fraud. The stock market has never been a place that had guaranteed returns.
Right.
It has always been a place where the asset can be completely wiped away tomorrow. So that never was a place where you could put all of your retirement assets. It's always been considered to be higher risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I grew up feeling that way because my grandmother lost everything, in the stock market crashes in the 20s. And so I didn't watch the lady get wiped out, but I dealt with listening to the scenario of what that felt like really my whole life. I don't have objections to people investing in the stock market if they are the investor. In other words, if you're using the tools that let you monitor the companies to invest in and picking your choices based on the trending analysis, and there really are excellent tools that do that, and you're deciding which things you're going to invest in, it's just something that you have a passion in. And, you know, and I know a lot of people like that who invest in the stock market because they're really passionate about tracking and trending and gains and all of that stuff. If that just is not your thing, that really is not where you should be investing. Because it is a riskier area, and if you're not getting any fun out of that, if instead it's giving you gut-wrenching pain, then that probably is not where you belong.
It's not so much gut-wrenching pain as it is real disgust, all right?
Yeah.
Well, and there really shouldn't be a disgust.
Can I ask a question here? Which is just there is a lot of corruption and there is a lot of ways in which there are frauds. I'd be interested in hearing a little bit more about if you do have extra money, is actually being able to invest it in things where there are ethics and helping the environment and not just seeing investment isolated from other values that you may have.
Yeah. And I think there are those kinds of things happening all over the place. Here again, though, this would be like, let's say, for instance, you want to invest in stock, but you're specifically looking for a company that is, you know, green or is using the money for some ethical venture you believe in. Actually, an example I can think of that just recently hit around here, there is a local church that is buying a church camp area. And in order to come up with the funding to pay for this thing outright, they're issuing what is essentially stock for their own parishioners and others who find out about it, of course, to give them the money that they need to buy this piece of property. And in exchange, they basically are, you know, going to kind of own a piece of the property on a tax basis. They're going to be given a certain percentage of return, with the idea of this being paid back to them in a 5-year span. For somebody who feels really strongly about that church camp, which many of these people do, that's an excellent place for them to invest their money. You know, the people who are doing it, you know, are showing from the outside that they're good stewards by some of the other historical things that they've done. You can feel good about where the money is going in terms of, you know, ethics and helping other people. And you can, by doing research on individual companies, you can find the pockets of places that are wise places for you to invest. And that, you may be doing stock investing, but you're doing it yourself. You're removing that middleman or middle company that is a brokerage firm that is taking a piece off the top when you bought that stock and a piece off the top when you sold it, and may or may not be ethical. and certainly didn't notify you at the time that your stocks were about to tank. They really couldn't, because their primary the primary thing that they're, of course, protecting is their own employer. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it certainly does. And I noticed, for example, in Toronto that the, I think it was the Social Innovation Center, which hosts a lot of green businesses and that they were mentioning some projects where they were asking people to invest. And in a similar thing, they were progressive and people knew where it was going. It was very direct, and people could feel good about their investment and see it actually going up in the Toronto area. And at the same time, they were protected in a sense.
Right. So in other words, what this is a company that is making the decision that they're not going to issue a stock or a bond in some sort of open, over-the-counter environment, but it's privately held. And you do the same kind of research that you would to invest in any stock, really. Because even if you're going through a brokerage firm to do your purchases, you really should know what your stocks are invested in. I think that's one of the challenges for people who have gotten 401ks, is that it's difficult for them to even find out what their money is being invested in. And the odds are a lot of it is in a money market fund of some sort, which is a mixture of companies, some of which might not be companies they would invest in if they knew that they were in that mix.
Candace, did you have any other question, or I'll open it up to see if other people have questions?
Did that add to the confusion?
No, actually, that's great, and I'm fine with questions. I really appreciate the responses, Peggy.
Uh-huh. You're welcome.
This is Brent. Can I
Great, Brent.
Make a comment?
Fire ahead.
I'm a financial advisor here in Canada, and I for 30 years, and what I hear and what Peggy is saying is two things. One is that she really broke down everything that we try and give advice to clients in like about a half an hour go, which is extremely hard to do. So you covered a lot of the areas that I would certainly want to talk to clients about. I liked your idea of knowing where you're investing your dollars and who you're trusting to do that. You know, where are the fees? You know.
Right.
A lot of people say, well, my bank's not making any money on me investing in my, our 401ks or IRAs are known as RRSPs, retirement savings plans here in Canada. You know, and they say, well, geez, we're just the bank. We don't make any money on that. No, you do, you know, and you're under a different set of regulations than I am because you have bigger lawyers. So they will sell stuff that is very inappropriate and just say, sue me. However, you did cover a lot of the awesome areas. I think that one of the ones that I would talk about that's gotten us in the past is service fees and penalties. Canada, if you file your tax return even 2 months late, they may assess up to a 50% penalty on what you owed them.
Wow.
So that's one of the things here in Canada that people don't know is the nice little tax man on the corner that we all know and not love so much, but if they want, they can really hurt you here in Canada. So one of my bents here that I've concentrated on for years is showing people how to reduce taxes and stay very right with the tax department, because if you're fighting them after the fact, and good luck, you know, they just don't relent.
Yes. Well, that's another area where you really need to know the rules about all the things you're involved in. In other words, if you're investing in real estate, there are rules. If you're investing in, IRAs and 401ks, there are rules. And if you don't know them, then you need to know who the expert is that you can trust and turn to.
That is so, so true. It's like a friend of mine. His sister, he's a real estate investor. His sister says, I've got 10 grand. And I was at a seminar where I can use that $10,000 to buy all these properties. And he says, why don't you go take a course for a year before you do anything? spent a year getting educated, not knowing that what the guy says in the seminar is not the whole story. It sounds really good, but there's a thousand things that can go wrong, you know. But
exactly. There's a lot involved with real estate. Yep.
We definitely talk about pay yourself first and start early, and that's where our first training came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, like I said, I so appreciate your, you know, kind of broadening the subject and bringing it down into a half an hour talk. One of the issues that we have is certainly not knowing how to save money. Again, I mentioned about is keeping it. That's why we're trying to work with Katie as much as possible, because her combination of the healing codes and EFT and knowing some of the issues certainly has in the past energized us to do better and manifest better. So that's kind of why we're here, is to learn how to manifest and get around our blocks.
Well, and actually, Katie has done a really great job of clearing a major block for me that I really wasn't aware that I even had. And that is because of the fact that I grew up in a family that struggled for money. I've always felt really comfortable in that environment. And there have been a few times in my life when the visibility of what I have in terms of assets has made me feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so there's a part of me that has thrown that out as a block. In other words, I'm more comfortable being poor.
Well, with us, I knew success. My dad, back in the 50s, was making $60,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And but he spent 5 minutes with his children every year. So we got sort of a different sort of a block over it.
Yeah.
And it's truly amazing all the blocks that people can have. It's like it's not only that we have blocks to getting money, it's we have blocks to keeping money. We have blocks
That's for me. I know how to get it. It's keeping it.
Yeah, and some of us know how to keep it, but not how to get it. And it's very interesting because it's all related to how you see the different emotional issues that did come up in your families or in your ancestors around, you know, for example, around visibility is a really important one, because having wealth is often seen as being a target. And thank you very much for the comments. I'm glad that it's been helping you. And what has around the clearing the blocks, what I also see is that not only do we have to we need to clear the blocks, but we need to clear the blocks also just to do some of the work that we need to do around our finances, because it's not just clearing the blocks. It's you have to take action around certain things. You have to find out more about how money works. You have to find out how the banks are taking interest off you almost every day from your account. And sometimes we don't do that just because we're afraid to do it. We find it boring, or we've got a block against being clear. Like so many of us want to just go and put our head in the sand around our finances because it's so overwhelming. So,
It is really important that you tightly monitor your revenue and your expenses. Preferably on a daily or a weekly basis. I know that sounds onerous, but if you're doing it that frequently, it's just little itty-bitty activities. And
do you have any suggestions? Because what I find, and I don't find it so onerous myself, although it's hard to be really consistent about it, but I know a lot of people that I work with find it so boring or so intimidating, because unlike you, they don't feel comfortable with numbers and things like that.
Yeah.
So, or even some of the terms that are used. Like, I know, well, even for myself, something like assets, somehow that word is
Project.
Intimidating.
Yeah.
And so what would you suggest they do? And how can financial experts actually help them?
Well, one thing that I really recommend to people, especially, you know, if you're doing anything computer related anyway, is get and get some sort of a software program that will do a lot of the tracking of this stuff and kind of remove some of the pain. And many of them are set up in such a way that, yeah, you in the background, you are preparing the same kind of financial statements as, you know, what a business would use. It's more human readable, and it's a little bit easier for people to understand that don't come from the financial world. But I also recommend that if you get a package like that, I personally am using QuickBooks, which is a huge application. I don't recommend that somebody start with that unless they're already tracking business stuff there as well. But I wouldn't keep separate books for your business or businesses and your own personal things, because you are going to swap money back and forth. And it does give a full, overblown picture of your full financial picture, as opposed to individual chunks for each of the business and then, you know, where you're at. And I think it makes the tracking a little bit easier.
Peggy, that's different advice than I've ever heard. And it's actually what I do, because I've never been able to manage keeping them separate. But all my accountants, everybody has been saying keep them separate.
No. What you have within most of the software applications that are available, you have the ability to code transactions to what mm-hmm. they're related to. So in other words, I code mine to personal or to whatever business it's related to. So I can still do reporting based on that area, but I still have a full financial picture of all my bank accounts and all my credit accounts, whether they're business related or not. And for me, that's worked out much more effectively. I don't want to be trying to make sure that things are all synchronized between multiple sets of books as I transfer money, for instance, from my business into my personal checking account or vice versa.
Okay. Now, I don't know if you've heard of it, Peggy, but one thing that I've started using, it was recommended by Barry, her name's going off, getting out of my memory right now, but a financial advisor, and she advises using mint.com, which is a very easy program to use to track personal, at least personal finances and some business finances as well, where you can see where you very easily can put all your bank accounts and things in there. Have you seen that?
I have heard of Mint. I haven't personally worked with it. The one thing that I will say, and this is, you know, me with my IT hat on here, I don't use online financial tracking mechanisms. I mean, I have online banking applications with the bank that I process transactions with, but I do not use an online version of QuickBooks. I use one that's standalone on my own computer and highly secured. I do not want all of my financial records out there in the internet. Now, that's me, I there are very few things that I put out there that broadly. I don't use an online backup program, I keep everything locked down pretty tight.
Well, that's interesting. It'd be interesting to check out what they're. What the security things are there. I've certainly found it very, very simple to use, which for me is like number one, because I can't tolerate high complexity. Sorry.
That's usually its big attraction. I think that's why a lot of people are drawn to it. I know the one that a lot of people use on the standalone PC is Intuit's version of it's Quicken. Not QuickBooks, but Quicken. And Quicken actually has some capabilities built into it that QuickBooks doesn't even have, like the ability to actually track your own stocks and interest calculations built into loans so that, you know, as you pay things down, it kind of tracks all that for you. QuickBooks doesn't do that.
Somewhat of a, to put it a little bit differently, I know a lot of people, and I'm partly this way, just have their things in different envelopes and keep tracking more on that basis. And then on a yearly basis, just give it all to the accountant.
Well, you know, that's another way of looking at it. I guess my perspective is that there is a reason why you're going to track your revenues and expenses on a really periodic basis. And that is so you at all times know where you are. If you wait until the end of the year and you hand it off to the accountant, it may be too late to do anything to make changes, and there may have been things you would have done differently had you known.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have envelopes too. I use them for filing.
Right.
But they're my basic activity and my whole world is captured electronically in my books.
Uh-huh.
Now, and there are some people who are not computer literate that do keep their own ledgers, you know, much like a bookkeeper used to do. If you don't want to do that work yourself, you can hire a virtual assistant to do that for you. There are people who do things like monitoring QuickBooks activities, for instance.
Right, right. So I'm going to see if there's some other questions here. Brent, did you have more questions there?
I totally believe in the tracking of your revenues and expenses. One of the most amazing things in the world is to see that people don't run with budgets at all.
Yeah.
And so what do you do to help people run with budgets and to actually keep tracking? Because a lot of people know that they should, but don't. Is there any fun way to do this?
A fun way.
Or how do you make it fun for yourself, Peggy? I know this because I keep getting asked this.
Yeah. I am not a person who does budgeting at the extreme detail level. But I normally start with a full-blown picture of all the individual must-haves in terms of, you know, what my spending is going to be on a monthly basis. So in other words, this would be things like, you know, a mortgage payment and power and telephone and all of that kind of stuff. And then I break down on a monthly basis what kind of additional funding needs to be there for things like, you know, meals out, gas for my motorcycle, because that is purely an indulgence. you have to allow, and this actually becomes kind of part of your 10% really for, you know, for entertainment or enjoyment or your own personal spending on yourself, but you have to allow that. And you might find that when you go through that exercise that the amount of money that you need in order to maintain the kind of life that you want to live is a higher number than what you thought it was. And so what that means is you need to take a look at the revenue side. You need to take a look at what you can do to increase your revenue coming in. Is that making sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for people then, it's a challenge of getting that increased revenue. I think particularly if they're in the startup or even the mid phases of a company.
Yep.
Where there's lots of possibilities of increasing the revenue, but none of them are sure.
Exactly. Yep. And you kind of have to evaluate, really, you know, all of your buying decisions. I mean, you have to separate the emotion from it and look at, you know, what the overall return is going to be. You know, when you make a decision and just dogmatically say, well, I refuse to spend this money for my business because the only way that I can do it is if I put it on a credit card and I am refusing to spend money on my credit card, that may be cutting off your nose to spite your face. Because you may end up then spending so much more time trying to do stuff, you know, kind of podge something together to take care of accomplishing what this one tool would have done for you, that you end up then with losing time to be able to spend with clients or some other thing that would have produced revenue. You've got to look at all the major downstream impacts.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. However, I think what can happen and what I see being used in people who are doing internet marketing is they're urging people to buy their product and that they're going to get rich quick almost. And what a lot of people are doing, and myself included, I've done that, is we invest a lot in all these programs thinking that they're going to bring us revenue. And when you look back, very few of them do. And in fact, they can be a source of impoverishment. And there can be, and I think I talked about this a little bit on my webinar, is there can be an addiction to education and getting more courses rather than taking action. So I think like all of these things, you really have to judge for yourself. Do you really need this course? Is it really going to help you at this time? Or do you really need this tool? Because I've bought so many tools before I really needed them, and I look at it, and it was a waste of money. I wasn't at that point in my business.
Yeah.
So, I think you're making really good points. And at the same time, everybody really has to look at their individual situation and gauge what at this point is really going to help you as opposed to in general.
Well, and when it comes to tool evaluation, you really need to consider all of the alternatives. I mean, you know, you get ads all the time for some, you know, new slick thing, but there may be alternatives out there that are free or cheap. I have a tendency to look for free or cheap first if it will do what I want it to do, and then go from there.
Can you talk a bit louder, Peggy? You're kind of drifting off a little bit.
Yeah, I was saying when it comes to tool evaluation, you don't want to buy a tool that you're not going to need and not going to use. However, when you do make a decision that there is a tool that you need to add to your toolbox, you need to consider all the alternatives out there, because in many cases there are alternatives that are pretty powerful in some cases that are free or cheap that will accomplish what you wanted to accomplish.
Exactly. And certainly when you're beginning, it's like there's a lot of tools that will help you later on. But it's really distinguishing at the beginning even midterm, that, yes, this is a great tool. It'd be wonderful, but it does not make sense to, even if it's only $10 or $20 a month, that all adds up. And, I mean, I was just somewhat flabbergasted when I looked at last year at all the business expenses I had in relation to, you know, income and seeing that, yeah, those were great tools, but no, I didn't really need them at that time, and so I just cut them all, and I actually did find a lot of tools that were free that could do the job. Maybe they weren't quite as easy, and, you know, I'm just adding certain ones when I really need it now. So,
Well, I think on the other side of that, though, you do need to kind of keep your radar tuned into what's happening out there in the industry as well, and not be completely closed off from alternatives. Now, one of the places where I've seen people kind of mess up on this one is not having their back office automated enough. And so as a result of trying
not to... Not having their what automated enough?
Not having their back office automated enough. This is
Could you explain that a little bit more in layman's terms, too? Because
Sure. If you are at all working in an environment where you're doing a lot of your own marketing, where you've got prospects out there on the horizon that you need to kind of touch base with periodically and do kind of follow-ups either in the form of emails or telephone calls, that kind of thing. If you're trying to do all of that on paper, you're restricting yourself to a certain size. If you start from the very beginning, automating your back office with some sort of a tool that provides some flexibility and growth so that you can monitor your contact list electronically. It's going to save you a lot in the long run.
So which sort of what would you suggest in this particular case as a resource or possibility?
Well, one of them that I've been really impressed with is a tool called SendPepper, which is connected with Office Autopilot, which is a real high-end back-office tool that is comparable in capability to Infusionsoft, but cheaper. And you don't have to start with, like, a $200 a month thing to do this if you're starting, you know, with something like SendPepper that then can be upgraded over time as you need the increased capability. Another example would be some of the web conferencing tools like MeetingBurner or one that's just recently been introduced called Wowie that start off with, you know, free tools for being able to do, you know, email and contact management that then can be beefed up as you have the need for, you know, additional capabilities in terms of web conferencing.
Great.
But if,
well,
if
maybe
you
can share some.
If you start with nothing, then you have nowhere to go. That actually could become a topic of its own, really, is tools evaluation. You know, and if you're starting out, for instance, with an internet-based business, there are some things that are really going to be almost required as part of the tool set.
Right, yeah. No, that is a whole topic, and I find a very interesting one. Over time, I've discovered what works for me. And, you know, you certainly can invest a lot before finding what really works for you as a business.
Exactly.
So I'm going to ask, are there any more questions there? And then we've actually gone a fair amount over time. Then we probably should close off for today. Does anybody else have a question?
I do have a question. I'm just going to preface it by saying that this talk today has, you know, has gone places where I have just refused to go for years, and I have very few of the tools that I'm using that were mentioned today. But I also know that I want to change that, and I'm trying to think, like, what kind of resources are out there? What kind of books could you perhaps recommend of sort of, you know, what could one do that would be like baby steps? Because I don't want to just go to somebody who's going to tell me what to
right.
do.
Right.
I want to educate myself slowly, but I don't want to scare the crap out of myself either.
Right. So now
are you talking about
in the financial arena?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I actually am getting ready to introduce a 6-month training and coaching program. Funny you should mention that. I actually have a webinar planned to introduce that. If you're interested in kind of keeping tabs with me as I move forward, Katie, are you going to be giving them information on how to contact me through my website or any of that?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And in fact, if you can just make sure you give me any of the information you want people to have, I can email it out to everybody who's involved in the group.
Because if you just go to my website, the main page there will, you know, has an opt-in form where you can actually get a copy of a video and a PDF report that actually was a chapter from a book that I was involved in this last year called Win, 35 Winning Strategies from Today's Leading Entrepreneurs. I have a chapter in there that it kind of talks about the relationship between time and money. And you'll get a free copy of that just if you go to my website and just opt in. If you do that, then I will make sure that you're included in the distribution list when I get my webinar all nailed down and start taking registrations. But I'm pretty close on that.
Do you feel that that's going to be as applicable for Canadians as it will be Americans, or are you going to try and address and do the languaging for both populations?
Well, I don't know what the languaging is for 401k, but I'll look it up. But that's actually not the major part, a part of my training. I do go into, you know, the four basic concepts and premises, but many of those things will be the same in Canada.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Any other books that we could read that would help us get over some of that initial, you know, anxiety that we have about even listening to things like this?
Well, let's see. What would I recommend? Gosh, I, as you can probably tell, I read everybody's stuff just because they've all got different perspectives on things. Probably the one I read most recently that, you know, is kind of an easy read and did a real good job, and he actually has some financial concepts that I'm really on board with. We don't agree on a few concepts, and you'll be able to pick them up when you go through the book, because some of it's what I talked about today. But the guy's name is Chuck Ryland, R-Y-L-A-N-T. He is a certified financial, what do they call it, CFP. I forget what that stands for. Anyway, which is something I'm not into at all. But he wrote a book called How to Be Rich, The Couple's Guide to a Rich Life Without Worrying About Money. And it's a relatively new release, short little book. I think I read it in a, you know, less than a day. It will kind of get you thinking about some of the same kinds of things that we talked about today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. And he's a friend of mine. He's a nice guy.
Okay.
Maybe, actually, just before we come to an end with this and have Peggy's summary, we could just have people perhaps say one thing that they've learned that they didn't know about and or that they that got reinforced this time, so that what they're bringing away, even though there's a lot of things here, I know I'm wondering, well, how would I know more? How can I find out more about that to really understand it? There's maybe one concept that is new or one concept that is helpful that you can actually do take a little step around. Michaela, I'll throw it to you. Was there something
you
can take a little step around?
Yeah. Well, I think what was really good for me was just to hear again how we cannot afford to starve our businesses, and that it's really short-sighted when like at times I can get really lasered in on reducing our debt, even though I don't think in a general way we carry more than the average. In fact, I think we carry less than the average, but I can get kind of single-focused, and just to hear that today about how important it is. And to be, and I can't remember quite the term you used, but it was sort of like always considering like what the consequences or the impacts are going to be down the road.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
So that was really good for me. Thank you.
And that's a really helpful point to bring up and to reinforce for the rest of us. Is there anybody else who would like to say something before we go into the summary? I'll just wait one more moment.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Yes. Great.
Hi there. It's Leandra.
Hi, Leandra.
Hi there. I really enjoyed this today. Thank you very much, Peggy.
You're welcome.
I was thinking that what kind of came up, a good reminder for me, was to know what your values are so you're not living anyone else's. Just kind of a nice, I knew that before, but it was nice to be reminded of it and have it reinforced.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. So what
we'll move into Peggy having a chance maybe to summarize some of the concepts that she talked about or to say something extra that may not have been covered. So, Peggy, I'll leave it to you now.
Well, I think I probably summarized as I was going along. And actually, I think a couple of people have kind of put a summary in there that fit really well. And that's primarily that you want to make sure that the life you're living is moving toward all of the things that are important to you. And, you know, let a lot of the other stuff go. I think right now we're all going through upheaval with all of the general changes in the economy. Those are cycles that we've gone through in the past and we'll go through again. You do need to make sure that you kind of keep your liquidity situation to the point where you've got cash available to you that you can use to cover things for an emergency situation. And then you just got to be flexible and ready to change if that's what it takes.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very helpful summary. And it's been very enlightening today from a whole load of angles. So thank you very much for coming on this call. And for people who listen to it afterwards or have questions coming out of it, you can always post them up on the Facebook wall as well.
And you can reach me at Abundance by Design. That's my website, abundance-by-design.
Yes. And that's the other thing is to get hold of, you can get hold of Peggy. You can visit her website. And can you just repeat that? It's www.abundancebydesign.com. Is that it?
It's abundance-by-design.com.
Great. So, yes, and I will send out that information to people as well so that you've got that on, in an email easily accessible. So thank you so much, Peggy. It's been a wonderful informational talk about and interview about all this, and I'm sure a lot of everybody who's on the call and also the people who are listening it will get a lot about it out of it to really think about and to digest in many ways. It's not a lot of the concepts are not ones that we're going to necessarily get right away. I think you've explained them really simply, but there's some of those things that we just really need to think about more and integrate into our lives. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye then.